next episode, we're going to explore what happens after wars, genocides, and all sorts of conflicts. That's when restorative justice comes in. What is it? I've got a chance to talk to Dr. Bani Ibawo. Dr. Ibawo teaches human rights history and African history in the Department of History and the Center of Peace Studies. He also teaches in the McMaster Arts and Science Program and the Institute of Globalization and the Human Condition. He has taught in many universities in Africa, Europe, and North America. His research interests are global human rights, peace conflict studies, legal and imperial history. He has published in many journals. He is the author of Human Rights in Africa, Imperial Justice, and Imperialism and Human Rights. Dr. Ibawo is member of the College of New Scholars at the Royal Society of Canada. He is a recipient of the McMaster Students' Union Teaching Award and the Nelson Mandela Distinguished Africanist Award. Dr. Ibawo, welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you.
First question, what is restorative justice?
Yeah, so restorative justice essentially means a process, usually a judicial or quasi-judicial process aimed at repairing societies in the aftermath of conflict or in the aftermath of abuse. It is generally described as restorative justice in the sense that the ultimate goal of the process is to restore society, to restore community, to restore individuals to a place of harmony before the conflict. So it is premised on the notion that abuse or conflict or violation results in broken relationships. So relationships get broken. And the premise of restorative justice is that we need to work together to restore that relationship, either in the context of individual relationship, in the context of national relationships, and sometimes even in the context of international relationships. So that in a nutshell is what restorative justice connotes.
So it doesn't have a preventative angle to it. After things happen, then restorative justice applies at that point.
Yeah, so restorative justice typically does not stand on its own. Restorative justice is often part of a peace-building package. So just to give you an example, in international relations, for instance, restorative justice will often be connected with active peace building. Sometimes this is in the aftermath of conflict, but peace is an active process. So sometimes restorative justice, you know, go hand in hand with active processes of building peace in communities. But I think you'll be right in saying that restorative justice often comes into play in the aftermath of conflict. Otherwise, if justice is not, if the relationship is not broken, there will be no need to restore it to begin with. So yeah. It's premised on a broken relationship.
Today in West Africa, we have conflicts, say, between the Fulani and other ethnic groups. How much restorative justice can play into that?
So restorative justice will always play a role in most conflicts. The question generally is, when does it come in? Restorative justice often can only work when the guns fall silent. So if there's an active conflict, you know, it's a moot point to begin to talk about restorative justice. So within the United Nations peacebuilding agenda, for instance, the first step is to stop the conflict, to stop the warring parties from, you know, killing each other. So, you know, blue helmets are sent to the ground to stop the conflict. And I think in many of these conflicts, particularly the one you referred to in the West African region, you know, the Fulani conflict, the problem, or Boko Haram for that matter, the problem is that the guns have not yet fallen silent. So the atmosphere for a full deployment of restorative justice processes does not even exist to begin with. But having said that, I know that there are initiatives to begin the dialogue, even as the conflict continues. Sometimes, you know, you don't wait until all the guns fall silent before you start the process of peace building. and restorative justice. So I know, for instance, that even as the military campaign continues, there are, you know, initiatives by government agencies, by non-governmental agencies, by international agencies to start a process of dialogue, not fully a restorative justice process, but more of a peace-building process to provide a basis for restorative justice when the conditions are conducive.
One facet of restorative justice is what happened, for example, in Rwanda, or even South Africa, like with the whole peace and reconciliation. Considering what's happening recently in Zimbabwe, where the government has appeared to pay white farmers, is that restorative justice?
Yes, it is restorative justice to some extent. You see, the restorative justice process is often centered on the victims, victim-centered justice. So that's restorative justice typically have at least three main goals. The first goal is victim-centered justice, repairing the harm. The people whose rights were violated, who were victimized, how do we repair the harm? The second part of the restorative justice process sometimes is, you know, reconciliation. So we've repaired the harm, now there's a basis to reconcile a society. And along those lines, you can think about a third strand of it, which might be nation building. So restorative justice, it's not just about reconciling individuals, but it's also about nation building. And of course, with that, you have things like memorialization, commemoration, and all those other things to kind of restore society. But it goes back to the point of who is the victim here? How do you define the victim? So there is a political aspect of the restorative justice process. So if you say, well, one set of victims deserve more attention than the others, then it's a flawed restorative justice process. And so ideally, one of the first debates that comes up when societies are thinking about restorative justice processes is saying, how do we identify the most vulnerable, the victims of the process? And in this case, so the white farmers, some of them were legitimate victims, and I see there might be a real basis for deploying restorative justice in that context. But I would argue that much of that would be meaningless outside the overarching debates about post-colonial justice in countries like South Africa, like Zambia, like Zimbabwe. In fact, across Africa, that you begin to think, well, yes, this is a specific group of victims, and we can apply a restorative justice paradigm to that, but there are also other victims. There are victims who were dispossessed as a result of colonial policies. What about restorative justice for them? I mean, so we need to think about this in a more holistic way rather than a fragmentary way, I think.
I want to quote your book, Seeking the Political Kingdom, where you say, African invocations of human rights were less animated by individual protection from the states. Their lodestar was securing a state to protect their rights. And I wonder what that means. Today, when we talk about the world, as far as nation building and Western democracy, typically African presidents tend to stay the longest, like in service. Is that what you mean by that when you say they're less animated by individual protection from state, but more to protect actually state's rights?
That's a very good question. So when I made that argument, and I've made that argument in several of my commentaries on human rights, I was talking about a particular historical moment in the evolution of the African state. So often in this context, we are talking about the 1950s and the 1960s. There were two different debates about human rights going on. In Europe, for instance, the debate about human rights were very much centered on the individual. You have to remember this was just after the Second World War, the atrocities of the Holocaust, the tyranny of the state, whether it was the Nazi state in Germany or the fascist state in Italy. Europeans could see how devastating the power of the state unrestrained could be on its citizens. So in the debates that were happening at the United Nations and in Europe about the new European Charter of Human Rights, The emphasis was on restraining the power of the state, the almighty power of the state against the individual, so that you do not have another Holocaust. You do not have another chaos that led to the Second World War. Now, the scenario was very different in colonial Africa, because in colonial Africa, the concern of people like Nyerere and Nkrumah and all these Ferreta Bars and like in Algeria, all these nationalists, their concern at that time was just get rid of the state, these colonial states, and institute an African state. So their kind of rights invocation was slightly different. So for instance, for them, they were not so much concerned with atomized individual rights, protecting insular individual rights. They were more concerned with the collective right to self-determination. Let's get independence first as a collective. Then we'll deal with individual rights. And that's where that terminology comes from, seeking the political kingdom. It actually comes from Nkrumah of Ghana, who says the first thing is to seek independence, the political kingdom, and every other thing would follow. So that was the premise. But that it would be a mistake to assume that that argument was valid for all time. You know, it was an argument that I would say was valid for that historical moment. You needed independence, and the emphasis was to create collective self-determination, the right to self-determination. But very quickly, it became a way of reinforcing the power of the state over the individuals. So the state came first. And who was the embodiment of the state? The father of the nation. So in some ways, that argument that served, you know, the state, the nation, the collective, however you want to describe these anti-colonial nationalists at the time, also became an instrument for perpetuating, you know, self-rule and justifying authoritarian rule. So my answer to the question is, it was an argument at a historical moment, valid for that historical moment, but we shouldn't lose sight of how that argument easily became a way of justifying authoritarian rule. I mean, give the example of Nkrumah of Ghana. He became increasingly authoritarian and had to be ousted in a military coup. And that is true of many of the political leaders, not just in Africa, but also in many parts of Asia of the time. So we need to put these analyses in their historical context and in the historical moment, rather than see it as something that explains how rights evolved throughout the continent.
In a way, I see a parallel between that moment and today. Yes, today when you talk about African integration, and even going back to that time, I mean, we know we had a missed opportunity as far as just building one African state or one African nation. Today, things are moving slowly with the African free trade area. How much of a drag or boost is it when you look at just the African Union in one side and then the regional union in another? A good example is West Africa with ECOWAS, and also the French-speaking countries with their own monetary system, the WAMO.
Yeah, so very good question. My simple answer to that would be it could be both. You see, it's not so much in itself, it's what African leaders make of this. So, and I'll give you an example. You know, these ideas about union for Africa are not new. You know, immediately after colonialism, you had the Monrovia group and the Casablanca group and all these visions of what a post-colonial, you know, country, a post-colonial Africa could look like. There were visionaries like Nkrumah who wanted the United States of Africa and later Muammar Gaddafi. That did not fly. And so the solution very quickly was, well, let's work at a regional level. And then you had all the regional bodies, ECOWAS and all that. But then very quickly, we're beginning to see again the limitations of that, the fragmentation of that, in the sense that the English-speaking West Africans have their own union, the French-speaking West African countries have their own union. There's a debate about who should be using the name, the ECO, and all that. That is an example of how the fragmentation can be problematic. But I can also give you an example of how a regional focus can be very useful as a way of building this vision of a united and more functional Africa. I take, for instance, again, the case of West Africa, the West African Examination Council. That is an examination council that has been established, I think, in the 70s, and it has thrived. African countries pool their resources to run exams. Think about the military force, I think, and there's even debates now about West African Electoral Commission, so that rather than each country struggling to build capacity to run elections, you know, are very expensive, and some countries have to rely on international donors to even have regular elections in Africa. So why not use the model of ECOWAS and other regional bodies in Africa to pool resources to run elections? Of course, that will have its own political implications and questions about sovereignty and all that, but it's a good debate to have. The way I see it, if already strong European countries are coming together to form a European Union, you know, to become even stronger, what chances have, you know, African countries, fragmented African countries? So my answer would be, regional integration is inevitable. It is the only way that, you know, many African countries can be competitive in an increasingly globalized economy. But there's also a potential for fragmentation if the basis of these regional bodies are not managed in a way that are complementary. If they become areas of competition and contention, then their purpose will be defeated.
In that segmentation, though, I've got to say, many see the hand of the old colonial powers, right? Divide and conquer. Because that's exactly what's going on today. COVID-19 is coming, and it's probably going to hit us very hard. But here we are, all of us asking for either freezing our debt payment or even asking for debt forgiveness. We cannot do that. We cannot negotiate individually. We have to do it as a group. That's the only way we have a leverage. Thomas Sankara tried it. But same thing, he didn't have any help. There were no regroupment around that idea. Isn't it the only way, though?
Yeah, good question. Yeah. So, you know, Thomas Sankara was only one example. The other example I have that many people do not speak about is Julius Nyerere. You know, this was not, a radical, you know, left-wing extreme Marxist or anything. But he had a vision of an Africa that was socialist-oriented. And in the era of the Cold War, there was no space for visionary leaders like Nyerere, who espoused a different way of thinking about how his country should rule. He was antagonized, you know, I mean, the history is very clear of how pressures were put on him. And of course, his Ujamaa and socialism is today called a disaster. But a lot of the scholarship do not look at the concerted efforts by agents beyond Tanzania to stifle that project. So it's historically leaders who challenge, leaders who dissent, have, you know, been punished for dissent, for not towing the line. But I think this historical moment provides a unique opportunity. And I'll tell you why. For the first time since, I would say, the end of colonial rule, Western liberal democracy is no longer the only game in town. Soviet communism and socialism is no longer the only alternate game in town. So you think about the 60s and the 70s, it was either you were pro-capitalist, pro-West like Mobutu Sese Seko Zaire, or you were Thomas Sankara seen as, you know, a left-wing Marxist leader. Very few African leaders had the opportunity to chart their own ideological and economic course. Today, I would argue the world is less polarized, and there are opportunities to look elsewhere, to think about ways of envisioning the country that do not have to follow some cookie-cutter model. I mean, for all the critiques we might say about Kagame in Rwanda, what is happening there is a government that is selectively picking and choosing what it wants to represent its nation. So yeah, we were once a French colony. Does not mean we have to be Francophone. We can also draw on the best of Anglophone tradition. We can be members of the Commonwealth. We can draw on what is happening in Singapore, which has been described as an authoritarian democracy, whatever that means. But countries like Singapore are showing that the Western liberal democracy model need not be the only approach for post-colonial societies. I mean, in the case of Singapore, for instance, the same one party has ruled in that country since 1959. And that party practically runs the country. Yet that country has one of the highest, you know, development indices. It has one of the highest transparency indices. Sometimes it is called a semi-democracy, a partial democracy. But the truth of the matter, it is working for the people. And I think for many African leaders, while the challenges persist, and I'm not going to say those constraints do not continue, there are many more models out there. And creative African leaders have opportunity to think about where we go for ideas, where we go for funding, where we go for bilateral, you know, arrangements and partnership. The world is a little bit more diverse than it was in the 60s, 50s, and 60s. And it provides unique opportunities for African leaders, and in fact, African peoples, to begin to choose their developmental models.
Yeah. With the diversity we have in Africa when it comes to languages, ethnic groups, and all that, do you see a model? And like you said, some like in Singapore, whatever happens there works for them. And you go in other areas where they see Scandinavia, it works for them. Is there an African model? Today, in many forms, Paul Kagame is viewed, President Kagame is viewed as the new African hero, an icon, a builder. Is Rwanda a model?
Yeah, you see, that's the other thing that I have, that I think we Africans should be very cautious of. We should not be desperate for heroes. Yes, models are useful, but we know where, you know, hero worship has led us in our history. And so we should be very cautious of that. Rather than models, I'd like to think about this more in terms of opportunities for learning. That's rather a model. Because to say, well, the Rwanda model works, that is where we want to go, it's going to be going back to the old cookie-cutter approach that hasn't worked for us. Rwanda is a very unique society. Yes, they had a genocide, but they all speak one language. It's a relatively homogeneous group. The genocide gave that country an opportunity to basically start afresh. Not many African countries have those opportunities. So I'll be wary of anyone saying, well, you know, Rwanda provides a model, and therefore that is what we should all be doing. It's obviously an inspiration. But I would say the debates should start within those communities. Like you rightly said, we have a lot more models, you know, the Scandinavian welfare states, you know, which is also something that many African countries can borrow from to the extent of their resources available to the state, the Singaporean case, but even the Chinese, I mean, in terms of what they have done, the economic transformation in that country within the past 5 decades, there are opportunities for borrowing. So rather than looking for one model where everything ideally works, I think the emphasis should be more on this kind of strategic and selective borrowing and learning of what works best. And it's going to be trial and error, you know, like in our post-colonial societies. But that would be my inclination, you know, strategic borrowing rather than seeking out ready-made models.
I want to go to a case that blew my mind. And it's a case that you mentioned in Imperial Justice, Africans in Empire's Court, the Amadou Tidjani case land. What's the background of that?
So yeah, this is a very interesting case that is happening in the 1920s. It's a long case that went to the British Privy Council, which is the highest court in the British Empire at the time. And the case was brought by an African chief, a Yoruba chief in then colonial British colonized Nigeria, Amodu Tijani. And he had taken the British government, the colonial government, to court for expropriating his land, for taking his land. And the premise of the British claim to Amodu Tijani's land was that many, many decades before, his ancestors had signed a treaty granting and the whole of all the lands in Lagos to the British government. And as such, the British owned the land. And the premise of Tijani's case was that in Yoruba tradition, the king did not own the land he was supposed to have given to the British. And as such, the treaty was flawed ab initio from the very beginning. Yeah. But what makes this case really, really interesting is that an African, an unlettered African, you know, Tijani was not educated, was able to muster the resources, the knowledge, to be able to mount a successful legal challenge against a British colonial government at the highest court of appeal in London. And it wasn't because Tijani was particularly wealthy. It wasn't because Tijani was rich. It was because he was able to mobilize his people to support, you know, his challenge of the state. So the bottom line was that the case set a precedent throughout the British Empire that irrespective of treaty provisions, land is supposed to belong to the people, and that any expropriation of indigenous land must be followed with compensation. Otherwise, such an expropriation was void under the law.
It was a fascinating case. Now, although this happened literally a century ago, and I wonder, so this is in a way someone who beat the British Empire, someone who were able to put some pressure and leverage and actually made a good case for his claim. The situation we're in now, does that case, can that be ground for us asking for reparation, for colonization, or is that a stretch?
Well, it can provide an inspiration, but you have to remember, and this is something that I remind people when they read cases like this, and they say, well, it's great. You have to remember that the framework of the legal system, even the Privy Council, was run by Britain. So the court system, the entire legal system, the judges of the Privy Council, we're all Englishmen and all that. So in some ways, in my book, I also made it clear that although Tijani was able to be successful in this case, we have to remember it was within the framework of the limits of possibilities within the imperial judicial system. So I give you an example. What if Tijani had taken a case to the Privy Council in 1920, questioning the very legitimacy of colonial rule, and said, well, you British have no basis to be in Yoruba land anyway. So my case is that you're violating my right to self-determination. I want the British out of Nigeria.
I would say it's a valid case.
Yes, but it would not have gone anywhere. I can tell you that.
Okay.
It would not have gone anywhere. So my point here is that Tijani represents agency, but we also have to understand the limits of that agency. So the Privy Council could accommodate cases like this that dealt with, you know, economic issues, to some extent social issues. But in my study of the Privy Council, I do not see anywhere where the Privy Council or even the British judicial system would have entertained a case that questioned the very legitimacy of the British Empire or the colonial state. So that for me, it's instructive because it tells me if this is going to be a model, then of course we have to think what is the framework and what are the possibilities within that framework. It goes back to questions like the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice. What is possible within the framework of this international institution? So the question will be, what would be the equivalent of the British Judicial Committee of the Privy Council today? You know, you might say it's the International Court of Justice, it's the ICC. And then the second question would be, just as the Privy Council, Privy British Privy Council had its limitations and what it could entertain within the purview of its mandate. What the limitations of international judicial institutions like the ICC, like the ICJ today, that might make it possible for them to address one form of injustice, but not another form of politically sensitive injustice. So yeah. those kind of gives you a sense of both the possibilities and limitations of the Tanny case being a model for questions of historical injustice and reparations.
I actually do see the limitations. Applied to today's world, I think part of it is that who runs those institutions? I don't know of an African or continental institution tackling those issues, because we cannot go to Europe and sue. We may be heard, but it's not going to go anywhere. We don't have institutions. Even if today it won't do much, but it starts a debate, and who knows where it's going to take us. I think I, for one, would like to sue them all. I mean, I'm not saying Europeans, but I'm talking the colonial empires, because they owe us. We are in this situation, this dire situation we cannot get out of. Even today, earlier we talked about ECOWAS and WAMU. A lot of people see the French, the country's hand in it as far as holding us back. And I, for one, definitely believe in that.
Yeah, so I totally agree with you. I mean, it all comes down to economic power and leverage. And that is why I think this moment of global racial reckoning provides an opportunity to recenter these debates, because for so long it appears that, you know, it was just wished away, you know, colonialism ended and then that's it. And many of the failings of the post-colonial state, you know, were brought down to the failures of political leaders and, you know, the kind of organizations in the state. And I would say that some of that is a legitimate criticism. But what has often happened is that the larger structural issues that have made it impossible for many African states to get on their field have not received the kind of attention they deserve. But I think now there is an opportunity to have that debate, whether it's about reparations for slavery in the United States, or even the kind of debate about reparations for, you know, decades of colonial exploitation in Africa. There is an opportunity for that debate. You probably know of the case in 2014 where some Mau Mau, so some Kenyans who were tortured and victimized under the British during the Mau Mau insurgencies in the 1950s in Kenya, successfully sued the British government for these human rights violations and were paid some compensation. You know, it wasn't very much. The British government also committed to building a memorial to the atrocities in Nairobi, which has now been built. It wasn't a lot, you know, in terms of structurally changing the equation, but it was very symbolic because in making that compensation and coming to that settlement, the British government acknowledged that atrocities and indignities were visited on Kenyans during colonial rule that deserved to be repaired. And that was their way of repairing it. And I wonder if that can become, again, not so much a model, but a reference point for what is possible in terms of repairing the centuries of exploitation and damage that has been inflicted on Africa by the colonial.
Yeah, that's jurisprudence. I mean, that's ground for, you know, opening other cases. Another case, for example, is the Namibia case, where yes, the Germans actually have been, they made it their laboratory for the actual Holocaust they did in Europe.
Yes.
And I wonder, even today, if they recognize those atrocities.
Yeah. So that is the other point. And I think that what needs to, the conversation that needs to happen is how, what form do reparations take? What form do the repair of the historical injustice take? I mean, there is value in making cash payments, you know, individual cash payments. But I think this invites a broader discussion about systemic reparations. So what are you going to do to try and put these societies back on track as best as is possible to repair the damage that has been done. And that is a conversation that has to happen both within Africa, because frankly, I don't think that's a conversation that will happen in isolation of the internal debates about the leadership failures in Africa. So while those debates are happening externally, we also have to have conversation within nations, within societies, about how to strengthen governance, how to strengthen political participation, because there's no one size fits all. There's no one solution to many of these problems.
Yeah, I would think it would start by forgiving all our debt, for one. That's a start, and it'll go from there.
Yeah, but that's the point, is that if they forgive all the debt and the structures are not in place to make sure there are no dictators who will start accumulating more debt, the point is moot, you know. So that's what I always say. It has to be a two-pronged approach. So yes, we're pushing for the debate about reparations and debt forgiveness, but at the same time, there's a debate about how do we create institutions such that those kind of burdening debts that have crippled many African economies do not recur. I mean, we see what is happening with China now and the loans that are being taken, you know. And, you know, some people like me, we worry that we are seeing again what we saw in the immediate post-colonial era, you know, the accumulation of debts that cannot be paid back. And the questions of what this means for national sovereignty and what this means for the independence of the people, what it means for the right of leaders to choose. We just talked about that. Choosing what models to borrow from to make your country work. Now, if you're inhibited by debt and you're crippled by debt, your frame of choices are limited. And these are some of the conversations we also need to have.
I would just ask you, if you have any thoughts of what's going on today in Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire, where President Ouattara is running for a third term, knowing that we just went just yesterday to a civil war, does that worry you?
It worries me a lot. And there's a reason why it does. For a very long time, Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, was seen as a model of stability in a region that was troubled, particularly in the immediate post-colonial period. I mean, when communism swept across and Marxism and socialist governments swept across much of Africa, Cote d'Ivoire was presented as an example of the triumph of, you know, sensible, liberal market economics in Africa. You know, the Hufubonis were seen as the model. So it really saddens me that, you know, in some ways, Cote d'Ivoire couldn't maintain that again, the model of stability. But to answer your question, what is troubling for me as someone who reads the continent generally is that I have a theory, and the theory is that for Africa to not just survive, but thrive into the next century, you need certain power players, national, regional power players. And you see this in every region of the world. You think about the European Union, for instance. It is really Germany. It's the German economy that is really pulling the rest of Europe along. And there are weak countries, there are medium countries, there are strong countries. But you have the power players like France, who used to be Britain. Now they've left, you know, France, Germany, and the rest. And my theory was that Ivory Coast, Nigeria, in West Africa, South Africa, in the southern part of Africa, Algeria, you know, Egypt in North Africa, the Congo, you know, with all its resources as a part. So we'll have these strong nations with strong institutions, with strong militaries that can provide a stabilizing force for the region. And so the fact that what is happening in Ivory Coast, I see as a recipe for further conflict, it's one that concerns me, not just from the context of the destabilizing effect it's bound to have on, you know, on the country, but also potentially on the sub-region. And this is the story, the arbitrariness of governance, that rules can be changed and made up as you go. that is often the problem, and that is one of the challenges that we've historically had in Africa. If rules can be made up as you go, it means that there can be no stability of institutions. It means there can be no stability of processes. Yeah. And that is what worries me the most about what is happening.
Yeah, I think part of it is even how we are so selective, like in West Africa, at least. I mean, and Nigeria has played a role in basically stabilizing Gambia when President Jammeh didn't want to leave. President Obasanjo came in and mediated, yes, and the guy's out. But it looks like people operate through those, in those spheres, like Francophones and Anglophones, and that's quite detrimental. I think Nigeria is the one to really run the ship in West Africa, but it looks like they don't have much appetite for it.
Yeah, because that again goes to the point about the legacies of colonialism. It's inescapable, because even in West Africa, it's almost as if you have two regional blocks within the region. I mean, that's just the reality. Monetary blocks, you know, military blocks, you know, and until we begin to find a way to think about how to work together. I mean, let me give you a classic example that I've been following recently. It's Boko Haram. I mean, this is a conflict that affects Nigeria, affects Niger, affects Chad, affects Cameroon. But even there, where it is obvious that the strategic military interests of all these countries are at stake, you're beginning to see the divide, the cleavage between the Francophone agenda and the Anglophone agenda. And it's just not create the kind of synergy that you would expect these countries to bring to the table to defeat the insurgency. And so, and that is the really sad part, that at every point you see stamps of the legacy of, you know, the very rigid colonial divisions. But again, it is the responsibility of Africans, it's the responsibility of leaders, borrowing on models from other countries that have endured colonialism, that seem to be thriving or, you know, working their way through it, to see how we can build, you know, some kind of regional and continental cooperation that addresses these differences.
Yeah, we're too divided to have any meaningful leverage, especially working in the, just a globalized scene. As far as Pan-Africanism goes, do you see an actual link, or do you think that's where really our prayers are as far as Africa moving forward? And by that, I mean North America, where you have, for example, in Congress, you have a lot of Black lawmakers. Yeah. In Canada, I'm not sure really how it is. I don't imagine it's the case. To make any meaningful changes, you need leverage. And to get the leverage, you need laws. To get the laws, you need people who actually represent you and your interests. Do you see anything like that that would help Pan-Africanism in general?
Yeah, I think this is something that I think is actually one of the strengths that we have as Africans that we can leverage. I'll give you an example because to give you a sense of how powerful this is. In the 1960s, and those of us who are historians, we've gone back, we've read the archives, the greatest thing that was feared by the American, you know, the racist regimes in the United States, in Europe, was a convergence of Africans in the United States and Africans in the continent. So when people like Marcus Garvey and Malcolm X began to pay pilgrimage to Africa, and African diplomats in New York begin to raise questions about the plight of the Negro on the floor of the General Assembly, that was scary. Because then what you are combining, it's a continental power. And we see the power. We're beginning to see snippets of that power in the Black Lives Movement. Soccer players in Britain and across Europe taking a knee over this issue, you know, people in the United States, statues falling in Europe, in Germany. Yeah. A global movement, it's not because of economic power, it's people power. Because these people are visible. One of the legacies unfortunate legacies of the slave trade is that there is no region of the world where you will not find Black people. Those who went long ago, those who were carried there, you know, during the slave trade, those economic migrants like us who have decided to come. The fact is that we constitute a very important power block. And I think what is required is a way to harness this. And it doesn't have to be one big harnessing of the process. It could be regional power blocks, alliances that work. And this is not easy because for so long, for instance, when I first came to Canada, we have here, one of the mentalities was to identify with Africa was not desirable because Africa is backward, Africa is negative. So you don't want to identify with the continent. And that came from a history. But you begin to see now a challenging of that, you know, that stereotype and more, you know, African-Americans going back to their roots, those of us who are coming here building synergies. So I think we have no option. It is one of the main weapons we have to be able to challenge the systems of oppression and domination that affects us both in the continent and in the United States. Just one final example to show you what is happening now and why this point is very important. I chair the United Nations Expert Mechanism on the Right to Development. After the killing of George Floyd in the United States, the United Nations issued a statement, a very important statement in the Human Rights Council about that. And that was led and made possible only with the support of African diplomats, the non-aligned movement. The United States was against it, was strongly against the statement, but the African leaders, because they have the diplomatic voice. You know, our brothers in the States might not have the diplomatic voice, our brothers, immigrants in Europe might not have the voice, but the diplomats came together to say, this is important enough. And now I'm writing thematic studies for the United Nations on racism and the right to development. So the multiplicity of voices at the diplomatic forum, at the economic forum, provides a way for us to synergize our powers and our influence in a way that uplifts us as a people.
Yeah, and you can even get more powerful if, because I see the link between the continent and North America and Europe, but I don't see any link between us, that group, and say the Caribbean or just Brazil. Unfortunately, I think that would be quite powerful as far as
that, I mean, and these are not accidents. I mean, these are histories of this connection. I mean, you know, slavery, they couldn't speak your language, you know, you're not allowed to speak African language, you're not allowed to, you know, do any African. So it will take time, but I think there are signs that some of these barriers are breaking down. I mean, one of the greatest Pan-Africanist movement of the 60s and 70s was led by Marcus Garvey, Caribbean. You know, Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa is a classic writing that empowers scholars of African studies around the world. He was, you know, a Caribbean scholar. So there are these historical connections we can build on.
Yeah. Professor Molefi Kete-Asante.
Yes.
He's been to Jamaica with Marcus Garvey's son and talk about education with the Ministry of Education. Because in Jamaica, they don't teach them the actual history. And when they make the case, they need to know. The minister said, this is a quite diverse country and we cannot just privilege some. Although this is a 90% Black country.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very awkward argument. I mean, you say the history and that's it, the history. It's not known, you know. When I write these things in my book, people say, oh, I didn't know that. I'm like, because it wasn't told. It's not part of the mainstream. There have been big histories of Africa written by professors, you know, who have privileged information, but it's not on their radar.
They don't teach us anything in class. Growing up, I learned more about French history than my own history.
But that's why podcasts like yours are important, that hopefully they spread the news. And that is why I don't dismiss popular media, social media. these WhatsApp groups. I know they can have, they can be toxic in the way they spread misinformation, but they can also be a source of education, you know, movies, music. So look at the kind of Pan-Africanism that is happening in movies or even in music industry, the collaboration between Congolese musicians and Caribbean soca players and West African Afrobeats. So in some ways it's happening in popular culture, you know. Surely. We just need to elevate it to the level of politics and economics so that we can reap the benefits.
We're getting there. We'll see what the next 20 years will bring us.
Yes.
Dr. Ibao, thank you so much, and I really appreciate it. The conversation continues on Twitter and Facebook. And don't forget to subscribe on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.